One of the things that I appreciated the least about Theravada Buddhism when I first came across it and has become one of the things that I like about it the most now, and that's all the lists. And of course, one of the frustrating things, I think, for many people in practice of meditation, Buddhist meditation, is how difficult it is to have any clear idea of how much progress you're making. And I often observe that in Thailand, many people assume that the spiritual path is like climbing a ladder, kind of stairway to heaven. So, you know, if you've been a monk for 5 years, you're five rungs up the ladder, and 10 years is 10 rungs. But it's more like snakes and ladders than simple ladders. And there are a lot of things that can pop up in your life, usually results of old karma. It can happen at any period in your life. Some monks go through very smooth sailing through their 20s and then hit a wall in their 30s. And some people are struggling every day through their 20s and things get better in their 30s, and so many different variations. But if there's not this kind of steady accumulation of meditational prowess and general kind of spiritual maturity to give us this reassurance that we're on the right path, then, you know, where do we look and how can we be sure that we're not kidding ourselves or in a little kind of bubble? And this is very common observation of people in cults, that they constantly rewrite and reinterpret what goes on in their life to fit in with their belief system. So we want to avoid that if possible. There is a wonderful, I think, very simple answer to this question given by one of my teachers. And he said, before you start practicing, it's very easy for you to suffer and very difficult to be happy. And if you're practicing correctly, you should find the things that make you suffer diminish and the things that make you happy increase. And that's a very good rule of thumb. You know, it may seem overly simple, but if we look at our own experience and the experience of people around us, I think would concur that chasing after happiness most of the time, and that chase itself is not particularly pleasant, and then the happiness that or pleasures that we do experience tend to be short-lived, easily undermined, easily submerged by events and by just the changes within ourselves and other people. Our body is not designed, or is this not evolved in a way that it can experience pleasure for very long before we've been physically satisfied for very long. Then the needs for rest, for food, to go to the toilet, whatever, take their toll. But the kinds of happiness that we can experience there, we can say they are real and legitimate. But the problem remains that until we've trained our mind, then We are always the prey of negative emotions, thoughts of anxiety, worry. We maybe get something that we really wanted and enjoying it, and then that thought creeps into our mind, or what if I should ever lose this? Or what might happen to threaten this? So imagination takes place, takes over, and creates all kinds of demons and unpleasant situations. And the nature of the mind is that the more easily you can picture something, the more real it seems, whether or not it's in fact a reasonable kind of expectation. So we have difficulty finding pleasure or happiness that lasts for very long. And when we do, it's very easily lost. As we meditate, we become more aware of how our minds work. And we begin able to protect the mind from unwholesome dhammas, and we become more adept in letting go of unwholesome dhammas that do arise. So the occasions in which we become miserable and happy diminish. At the same time, we begin to observe that the most important element of a fulfilling and happy experience is the quality of mind that we bring to it. And as we cultivate the ability to introduce into the mind positive emotions, and we learn how to take care of them and to bring them to a flourishing in our mind, then the happiness in our life increases. So anyone who's been practicing mindfulness for any length of time will know that most simple kind of physical activities, ones you don't have to use your brain very much or don't have to talk with anybody very much, like cleaning, sweeping, washing things, like menial tasks, actually can be a source of great pleasure. And the work that monks do in monasteries is almost all, well, until very recently, you know, menial jobs. You know, we do a lot of sweeping and cleaning and polishing and all these kinds of things because it's really, really enjoyable when you can let go of negative emotions and not wanting to do things like that. Okay, so that's one way of looking at your mind and seeing, are there things in your mind you say, well, if I'd experienced that a year or two ago, I would have just fallen into hell, or I would have just been so depressed or upset. And now this happened, and it's not that I don't feel anything, but I get over it a lot more quickly. It doesn't go so deep. And there are all kinds of things that who knew that, you know, getting up early in the morning and meditating and exercising before dawn could be so wonderful. So there are all these kinds of discoveries. I think another very clear indication of progress in Dhamma is attitude to precepts. Now, one of the signs of a growing maturity in the human mind, according to Buddhist tradition, are these two mental factors, which are called the protectors of the world. Now, when we translate these into English, they don't sound so inspiring as some of the other Dhamma terms, and most surely they're shame and fear. So those don't sound like great spiritual accomplishments, do they? But I've taken to translating these terms as wise shame and wise fear, because they have some specific or unique characteristics. So the idea is that when we reflect systematically and often on our ideals, our goals, our aspirations in life, as human beings, as sons, daughters, as brothers, sisters, mothers, fathers, friends, citizens, then we, when we develop a very clear sense of what our standards, our values are in those spheres, then when we, the intention or the opportunity to behave or to do, to say things which are in conflict with those values, calls them to mind. And we experience this cognitive conflict, the sense that what I'm about to do or what I'm about to say is in direct contradiction with my most cherished goals. And when that happens, there's a feeling that arises, that sense of conflict. And that feeling is what Buddhists call shame. And as you develop this practice over the course of time, then the cognitive element diminishes, and the emotional element becomes the salient factor, becomes very, very strong. And so there is this sense of shrinking away from certain actions and speech. There's a colourful, memorable simile in the Visuddhimagga commentary. It says someone with this wholesome state of mind looks at unwholesome, unkind actions and speech in the same way as if he was invited or had a thought of excreting in the middle of a marketplace. You know, there's that sense of revulsion and shame. You know, no, that's not. I would never do something like that. So that's the sense of wise shame. So it's not just something you have or you don't have, but the extent to which it becomes a refuge and an immediate protection is the extent to which you have systematically reflected on your values and aspirations in life. So it's something you cultivate. The sense of fear is one based upon, or we could call fear of consequences. So you know whenever you want to do something that you know it's not really a very good thing to do, the last thing you want to do is to think about the consequences because you won't want to do it anymore. So you say, shut up, don't think about that. You have this kind of override mechanism. And that's a very dangerous thing to do. So you develop this ability to reflect upon consequences of actions in line with the law of karma. But particularly to begin with, which is like the easy way in, is reflection on how this would be seen by people that you look up to and respect, or wise people. So this is, it's said in the commentaries that the first quality of wise shame is consequence of self-respect, and the second quality of wise fear is of respect for others. So that's certainly one aspect of it. So being able to stop and to clearly consider the consequences of your actions, and it's recognition that those consequences are things that you will find very unpleasant. There's that sense of conflict there, and there's the feeling that arises is that fear. As again, the same process of the cognitive element tends to wear away, and the emotional element comes to the fore. And so in situations in which there is some pressure or some temptation to act in foolish ways, then you have these two protectors that arise very quickly and fluently to protect you from that foolishness. So the arising of those two qualities is a very clear indication of progress in Buddhist practice. And without them, our practice will tend to be one step forward and two steps backwards. So this Buddhist practice is, we could call it a holistic practice, in that there has to be a harmony of cultivation of action or conduct of the mind and of wisdom. So we can look at this in a number of different areas. Let me just give an example, common example. How do you deal with anger or bad temper? So one of the Buddhist sort of education and cultivation teaches us that we have to deal with it in the area of conduct, in the area of emotion, and in the area of thinking, understanding, or wisdom simultaneously. So in the area of conduct, our main tool that we use is willpower, or the intention to refrain. So we can't, as an act of will, decide that now I'm going to be a Buddhist, I'm going to love everybody, I'm going to look on everybody as brothers and sisters and mothers and fathers, I'm never going to get angry ever again. You can't do it. Nobody can do that. You can't decide not to get angry. But you can decide not to act upon anger. And that is very realistic. It's not sort of idealistic, cloud head in the clouds kind of mysticism. It's very practical. You make a commitment to yourself, to your family, friends, people around you, that, yeah, I still get angry every now and again. I still lose my temper. I'm working on it. But I promise you that no matter how angry I get, I will not hurt you, either physically or verbally. And that the Buddha said at one point, this is Mahadana. So dana means that an act of giving, of generosity. And the greatest gift that you can give to the people around you is a sense of safety. There's no possibility of a healthy family or a healthy community of any kind without a foundation, this foundation, a sense of safety. And we give this sense of safety to other people by not making unrealistic commitments and going on of idealism, but taking into account this capacity we have not to do things that we want to do when we're sufficiently motivated. And this is, I think, inarguable. You might see something, oh, look, this lovely clock here, might like to take that with me when I leave. And so, they say, well, are you going to take it? You can wait till everyone's gone away, guarantee nobody will see you. You could take it without anybody knowing. Would you take it? And I hope you would say, no, of course not. Why? Because it belongs to Ajahn Jayasaro. He'd be so sorry if he didn't have his clock to keep it. And so, out of consideration for me, or just a basic sense it wouldn't be right. You know, these are things that lead to real consequences in the world, isn't it? You know, we have a desire for things, all kinds of things, and we don't act upon so many of them. So that ability not always to have to act upon our desires and wishes is our tool that we use in order to cultivate our conduct. Now, with In the meditation just now, I spoke about, you know, looking at meditation as a learning process, as an exploration, rather than as something you do in order to get something at the end of it, like peace or whatever, however you articulate it. And one of the things that we're very interested in studying is the relationship between the inner and the outer world, or our inner reality and the way we relate in the world. So obviously, in terms of not hurting others physically or verbally, if you develop a loving kindness meditation, that's going to have a very beneficial effect. It's going to be that much easier to refrain from hurting others. So this is the inner influencing the outer. And that's almost like a platitude of spiritual life, isn't it? That the inner reality affects the outer. But there is also the observation that when we take on a particular practice and we sustain it over a long period of time, it changes the inner. So the principle here is, if you have an intention to say something hurtful, okay, then the more often you do that, then the more fluent you will become, and the more hurtful you will become, probably. But if you refrain, you have this desire to say something hurtful, and you just swallow it, okay. And the first time you do that, it will be extremely difficult. And probably the next few times, you find it gets a little bit easier. And you create a new habit. And this intention to be hurtful, it's not who you are, it's just a habit. Or it can be compared to a muscle. So if you're bedridden, you know that any muscles that you don't use start to shrivel. They lose strength. And similarly, if there are particular intentions that we consistently and consciously refuse to express physically or verbally, they start to shrivel. They lose their power. And this is a way that the outer affects the inner. So we're working from from the inside out and from the outside in at the same time. But the role of sila and precepts is to create these wise habits of conduct, which work to undermine the negative mental states that lie behind them. So with this practice of sila, of cultivating the intention not to act upon a certain action volitions, then we start to observe also a growing sense of self-respect. So in terms of self-esteem, it's a Western idea of self-esteem. You know, how do we look at that in Buddhism? I would say that the two pillars of self-esteem in Buddhist tradition are giving and precepts. Because every time, this is another example of how the outer affects the inner. Every time you give something, you share something, you are experiencing yourself as a giver, as someone who has something to give. And that is very, that strengthens the Buddhist idea of self-esteem. So this is a wonderful thing of alms round, you know, that I'm sure you've seen the Buddhist monks going out in the mornings collecting alms. And in Bangkok, most people will put some rice and then some curry or sweets. But in the countryside, it's certainly when I was a young monk, most people only put sticky rice in the bowl, just like a lump of sticky rice. So although nobody had any money in those days, everybody had rice. And it meant that everyone could start their day with an act of charity, of giving, of feeling that they are contributing towards the practice of the Sangha. And that was something that made them feel very good about themselves. So the giving and sharing, even of very small, insignificant things as a habit, as a way of life, creates self-esteem, also makes us feel happy. And the sort of central paradox of Buddhist practice is that you can only really understand suffering with a happy mind. If you're miserable, you can't understand what suffering means. And you can only go beyond suffering when you fully understand suffering. You only fully understand suffering when you're happy. So one of the things that you need to do is to develop this this love of giving and sharing. And I'm sure many of you do have this, but you know, many of us start off with experiencing it with our loved ones. So we find it very easy to give to people we love, but then observe that feeling, and it shows that you do have that capacity, and then expand it. And after a time, you'll notice changes that take place. You get anything, a nice thing, you know, and you just a thought that comes up in your mind straight away is, who shall I share this with? Or it'd be such a shame if I was just to use this by myself. Or maybe I'll give it to him or give it to her. He'd enjoy it more than I would. And these kinds of thoughts just arise completely naturally and spontaneously in people who develop this dana. And so for all the, you know, the problems and the, say, corruptions, weaknesses in Thai Buddhism, this is one area where I think you can see so many beautiful examples of people just see immediately, you can just see spontaneously this wanting to share, wanting to give. You can see in people's eyes and people's behavior. So dana and sila, giving and keeping precepts, gives rise to self-esteem. In this particular case of giving keeping precepts, what this means is that we voluntarily take upon ourselves certain boundaries for our actions and speech. And then over a course of time, we experience temptations and pressures to exceed those boundaries. But by being able to keep within the boundaries, then we have this self-confidence that, yeah, we have certain standards that we can sustain no matter what's going on around us. So going back to my example of anger here, so we've declared that no matter how angry we get, we're not going to express that and not going to hurt others. But that's not enough, is it? I mean, it prevents us creating heavy karma and creating even worse situations in our family and workplace. And it does, over a course of time, help to reduce the intensity of the anger. But there's still a lot more to do. And one of the most important qualities of mind that we need to develop, so this is in the emotional level. Now, we're learning to develop these wholesome dhammas which directly counteract the unwholesome. One of the key ones, of course, is mindfulness. And mindfulness knows that we're present to what's going on in the body and mind and the significance of it. So mindfulness is not just being in the present moment, but there is that presence of this wise fear and wise shame accompanying it. If there isn't, then it's going to be wrong mindfulness or not a real mindfulness. So if we look at what happens when we get angry, I think you'll notice that there are certain warning signs, physical warning signs, certain tensions. And people have it in different parts of their body. Some people just are tensing in their hands or their arms or their necks. And just notice what your own pattern is, where that very first inkling that, you know, just got this beginning of anger arising. And if you have observed that, and then you're developing mindfulness, then before this sort of full-blown anger arises in the mind, then you are aware of the physical early warning signals, and you can let go of it very easily. But sometimes you do become aware of it, but it's very strong, and then you need patience. So patience means being able to bear with things, forbearance. It's in Ajahn Sumedho's famous phrase, peacefully coexisting with the unpleasant. So patience doesn't mean like gritting your teeth. I mean, sometimes you have to grit your teeth, but that's really like sort of last resort. The ability is just to be with, to bear with the unpleasant. And then the mind is calling out to you, to indulge in this, and you just bear with it. You don't follow it. You don't try and get rid of it, but you don't follow it. You're just there, being with it. And when you do that, then that rush of emotion and anger washes away, and you can see the arising and passing away of a mental state. So this is the beginning of wisdom, vipassana. And you need mindfulness and you need patience just to be there and totally be there and allow something like this just to wash through your mind or just to pass through without leading on to volitional action. Loving kindness, as I say, is a very important factor, of course. That factor which directly negates the anger. Now, with loving kindness, I think a lot of people have real difficulty with obnoxious people. Yeah, so you spread all loving kindness to everybody except for this person or that person. And so, you think in terms of percent, well, I did very well, 99%. But it has to be 100% for it to be metta, for loving kindness. So in the case, there's somebody who's like really selfish, takes advantage of other people, actively enjoys the suffering of others. And you say, how could I possibly wish that person, may you be happy? I say, well, they're happy and making everybody else miserable. So if I wish them happy, then I'm therefore wishing everybody else to be miserable. So how does that work? But the answer to this, I would suggest, is that you actually take that particular personality trait or obnoxious feature, and you make that the focus of the metta. So if somebody who's very selfish, then you wish, may they know the happiness of unselfishness. Or if they're very cruel, they say, may they know the happiness of abandonment of cruelty. So rather than just trying to push, you think you have this kind of love in your heart, and you're pushing against this kind of who you think they are, you take what you find is the most objectionable element of their personality, and you say, may they know the happiness that would come from freeing themselves from that. So this is how you develop an all-round loving kindness, irrespective of the people and the particular qualities of those people. Then you have to develop, finally, this right thinking or wise reflection, because behind the anger there is usually some unwise thought or perception or attachment. In particular, these ideas of should and shouldn't. They're very big ones. Like, he should be like this. You know, he shouldn't, or she should, she shouldn't, it should, it shouldn't. And those are sure doors into the realm of anger. When we think that things shouldn't be the way they are, people shouldn't have said the things they said, shouldn't have done the things they did. They should have done something else. They should be different people. They should be better than they are. That's the kind of thinking to be challenged in overcoming anger, because people act the way they do according to causes and conditions. When we get angry, we're assuming an agent, who someone who does this, who is like this or isn't like that. But we can see from looking at our own minds that that's not really what's going on here. You know, even for someone who's trying to develop mindfulness and kindness and these good qualities, every now and again, their mindfulness slips and all kinds of negative thoughts can come into the mind. You can think the most awful things, things you would never dream of acting upon, but they arise in your mind when you can arise in your mind very easily when you lose your awareness. So being angry with yourself or being angry with someone else is a bit like, you know, the windows. Let's say the doors and windows here were open and a poisonous snake comes in. You know, you don't say this is a bad room because it's got a snake in it. The problem is that the room hasn't been protected against snakes. The necessary precautions have not been taken. There's not enough skill, intelligence, understanding how to prevent snake from coming into the house. And people's minds are like that. And people who are meditating and have been meditating for years can still experience very negative mental states and thoughts. And so how much more so for people who've never sought to train their mind at all? So this is, I think, an important way of reducing anger in the mind by looking very closely at what happens when somebody behaves badly. You know, what exactly is going on here? And the less you see it in terms of us and them, in terms of fully conscious functioning agents deliberately taking very unkind decisions and acting in unwholesome ways. See, it's a lot more complex. There are causes and conditions involved. And that's not a denial of personal responsibility. That's at a different level. But in terms of the psychologically what's going on, this is a way that a certain amount of forgiveness can arise. So understanding how thoughts and how intentions to behave badly arise due to causes and conditions and can so easily lead to unfortunate behavior, that observation is one which allows us to understand others and to let go of this anger. And if we look at ourselves in the past, we say, how could I have done such a stupid thing? How could I? You know, this kind of aversion to yourself. But that is the height of foolishness, isn't it? Because what you're really saying is, how could I have been that person on that particular day? I should have been somebody else. I should have been a different person. I should have been a better person. I should have been more kind. I should have been more aware. But what could be more foolish than that, to think that you should be somebody else? You are who you are because of all the causes and conditions that have led up to the present moment. and you were who you were on that particular occasion because all of the causes and conditions that came to play on that particular day. So having recognizing things as this play and very complex stream of causes and conditions, then we use a wisdom to enter into that flow of causes and conditions and to deal with it in those areas and those levels at which we are presently capable of doing so. So this is a just one example of how we use this threefold training, a training of conduct, training of the mind, training of wisdom, to deal with a particular problem like anger, a particular mental state, but also how we approach the cultivation, development of any positive emotion. So we want to looking after the natural world. Same, we need to have laws, regulations, customs, and so on to protect forests. But we also need to cultivate a love of nature, because stupid and negative things are a lot more easy to accomplish than wise and beautiful things. Like if we had 100 people in this room and we want silence, then every single person has to contribute to that silence. But if we want to make a noise, only one person is enough. And this is the same. And so before you can protect a forest, you have 100 houses. you have to have all 100 villages and all 100 families supporting you. If you have just one out of 100 house with a chainsaw, then your forest can disappear. So the good things in life and the wholesome things appear a lot more with a great difficulty than the negative and the difficult. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done in creating this, in the case of the forest, creating this kind of love for nature, and then on the level of wisdom, teaching the principles of ecology and the interrelationship between different life forms and how our very life on the planet depends upon caring for nature. So this same principle of sila, samadhi, panya, of conduct, heart or emotion and wisdom is something that can be applied in meditation and also generally throughout the world. So I started off talking about progress. So if you remember saying that should be overall over a period of time, seeing the things that make you suffer diminish, the things that make you happy increase, should see a growing presence of this wise shame and wise fear, and find that there is easier and almost natural to keep precepts and being able to use precepts as a means of training conduct and in a way integrated with the other elements of the Noble Eightfold Path. And last of all, I would say is that you don't stop. That's the main thing. You know, as long as you just keep going. It's patience, endurance, consistency. And remember the commentary, the inner commentary that arises about your practice. That's not something outside of the practice. That's part of the practice. And I tend to think this commentary, oh, my meditation's going well, my meditation's not going well, or in this, or in that. That somehow it's like the, you know, the commentator, you know, in this sort of the, with the bird's eye view of the sports game. But in fact, that voice, that is just one more part of the whole flow. That's one of the things that you should be observing. So don't identify with the commentary. Okay, that's the talk this afternoon. Thank you.